This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Today on the show, national security.
It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it.
Well, Big Brother, in this case, the Obama administration, is watching, but you already knew that, right? After more revelations, the government can track terrorists in the information age, of course. But where does that leave you and your privacy? New leaks show the NSA is not just tracking Americans' phone records, but also tapping into Silicon Valley's biggest internet firms. That includes Google and Facebook and Skype. Meanwhile, the president is in California meeting with China's leader. We have a look at U.S.-China relations in a new era of cyber spying. We'll check in at Gitmo as America's worst terror suspects continue their hunger strike there to protest their indefinite detentions. And it's Friday. That means movies. Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn play adult interns at where? Google. Movie Date's Kristen Meinzer and Rafer are here for a review. But first, the NSA.
As long as it doesn't reveal the conversation, it's fine.
It's a bit alarming. It always is, but it's just the fact that it could happen.
I think this is one of the most private things that they should not do it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty intense.
I don't think it's necessary.
It's not cool for them to do that.
Yeah. All of it is. Gives me the jibblies.
Verizon customers, they're reacting to news that the Obama administration required the phone company Verizon to provide all call data on all their business customers. But we've also learned that the NSA's collection of data is not limited to your cell phone. Through a top-secret, previously undisclosed system called Prism, the NSA has direct access to the data on the servers of Google and Facebook and Apple and Skype and other firms. In response, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper said last night, quote, "Information collected under this program is among the most important and valuable foreign intelligence info we collect and is used to protect our nation from a wide variety of threats." Clapper also described this surveillance as entirely legal. Well, for more now on how government officials use surveillance for counterterrorism, I want to turn to John Cutter. He worked formerly with the NYPD's Criminal Intelligence Section on issues of counterterrorism and is now president of Custom Protective Services and joins me in the studio. Hi, John.
How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us. John Cutter, explain a little bit about why the NSA would want to collect such huge volumes of data. Data smog isn't useful. How do they make it useful? What are they doing?
Well, you have to understand that it's almost reverse of profiling. You know, for years people complained, oh, you're profiling, you're picking specific people or specific information. They've turned it around now and they've broadened it. They've taken it out to a whole new level and they are able to bring in large volumes of data, and through computer algorithms they're able to track that data and pull out the information of people who may be filtered into our society that are involved in terrorism. And that's what they're trying to do.
I've heard this described in the last 24 hours as sort of a technical version of 6 degrees of separation. Everybody's connected to some degree, and this enables them to draw those lines in a way that might be useful to catch a bad guy?
Absolutely. What they're trying to do is develop patterns, find the anomalies within all of this data, because all of this data altogether is, for the most part, useless, and 90% of this data is not even looked at. There's probably a small portion, maybe 10% of this data, that as they go through it, they're able to find that a particular phone number calls 4 different numbers that are already tagged as involved in terrorism. So, wouldn't you want to know that?
Okay, so if there's somebody who's a suspected terrorist, let's say, suspected terrorist X, what they want to do is use the data to find all the branches, who they call, who they IM with, who they Facebook with, et cetera, and try to draw connections of somebody else they might want to look at?
Absolutely.
Okay. What does that mean? Somebody who's not connected with terrorism, like me, as far as I know. Now, maybe I am through some degrees of separation in a way that I don't know about. What does that mean for me, though? Because I'm not involved in any illegal or terroristic activities. On the other hand, maybe I have crossed paths with somebody who's a bad guy and I don't know it. I'm being swept up in the NSA, too. They're looking at my activity.
No. Generally, I think, you know, you're talking about a one-off situation here where maybe somebody that you've done business with, whether it's a car repair place or, some type of a food establishment, something like that, and a phone call has come to you on an irregular basis to come in and pick up your car, or, yes, you made a reservation. they're not looking at that. What they're looking for is the 98 phone calls that go to a particular number and have a certain duration and time to them. It's not, you know, the 1 minute, yes, I've confirmed that my car is ready, I picked it up. They're looking for more.
John Cutter, we learned yesterday that the court order that forced Verizon to turn over 3 months of records, phone logs, was for their business section, Verizon Business. Why? There are probably others that we don't know about. We have to assume, am I correct, that also AT&T, T-Mobile, the other companies are also being ordered? There's no reason to believe it's just Verizon, right?
Well, we don't know that for sure because—
What do you think, though?
They may have particular information relative to a terrorist cell or individuals who are planning something against America, and they know already that those individuals are connected through Verizon Business. So that may be why, so far, we've only seen Verizon Business. Could it be other carriers? Sure. But I don't see this as a blind attempt at trying to develop information. I see it more as they've got something and they need to fine-tune it. So they're pulling it all in.
Before we let you go, are you troubled more by the internet aspects of this, the IMs, the emails, Google and Facebook?
No, I'm less troubled by that because you have to understand the internet is the Wild West, and terrorist organizations and individuals who are involved in terrorism, they are constantly on there. You can find jihad websites all over the internet.
Well, there's the views of one cop. Can I call you a cop?
Sure.
Yeah, that John Cutter, formerly with NYPD's Criminal Intelligence Section, giving us his view on the NSA's surveillance of phone call records at Verizon and on the internet. Mr. Cutter, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the National Security Agency's collection of internet data now, audio and video chats, emails, documents, pictures, and more, has many internet activists up in arms. Our next guest says he isn't surprised, and he even sees a silver lining in this surveillance story. Joining us, Douglas Rushkoff, author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Hi, Douglas.
Hey, good to be with you.
We shouldn't be surprised by this, you say. Our data is out there. We live in public, and we have to get used to it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if we have to get used to it, but you know, we have to accept, as people like me have been arguing since, you know, the internet began, that everything you type onto a machine and distribute through a global network, I mean, you have to assume there's some traction out there. In other words, we've been typing messages into databases for a long time. We've been clicking on Facebook and saying what we like and what we don't. We've been putting, you know, global positioning devices in our pockets and walking around with these things on. I mean, did people actually expect that none of this stuff was being recorded?
Now, what about content versus aggregate data? We just heard John Cutter saying they're not listening per se. They're not reading your IMs. They're looking for aggregate data about connections to bad guys. Don't worry, they're not listening. You buy that?
Yes and no. I mean, for the most part, yes, we are not the people they're after. We're the control group. You know, so that by looking at all of the accumulated data about us and then as much data as they can about people who've done nasty things, it provides an easier way for them to pinpoint, you know, people who might be more likely to do some bad thing than people who aren't. But once you get in the habit of having everybody's data about everything, you know, it's real tempting to use it in a whole bunch of ways that aren't particularly aren't ethical. You know, as long as they're not worried about, their findings standing up in a court of law later, they can still look and find out different things. And, you know, I don't particularly trust government or corporations with this sort of data, with this kind of information.
Are you one of the people who was more troubled by the fact that Google and Apple and Facebook and Verizon have all of this information to begin with? And then the NSA getting access to it is just sort of ho-hum?
Well, we know that they've had. I mean, the thing I've been stomping, that's why I write all these books. I've been trying to explain to people for years that these companies have the data. I mean, that's Gmail is free, right? What do we think we're paying with? We're paying with our data.
Well, it's their business model. I mean, our data and our behavior is what Google sells to advertisers.
Right. It's already there. I mean, and I guess what we liked to think is that, oh, well, somehow corporations in some way are more trustworthy, or they don't really care. They don't really care if I smoke pot or not, so they're not going to come after me. And we have this notion that the only way the data is used is sort of in that, you know, in that CSI or Law and Order way, where after some murder's been committed, they'll go and then they'll check your, you know, check the phone records of the person who was killed to see who called them. But you have to remember, if that data's been there all along, then it's been useful all along. You know, and in some ways, the way it's being used now, we don't really object to, because, you know, they're not after us for anything in particular. But when a government can get into sort of nasty territory of selective enforcement, when you look at a guy like, you know, Eliot Spitzer, say, who he's doing something that I'm sure a lot of politicians do, you know, when they're going off to prostitutes. But when someone's after him, we've got the data to go prosecute him. And I think that's sort of where it gets troubling.
You mentioned Douglas Rushkoff, author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now, that the public is now the control group. Can you talk a little bit more briefly about what you mean by that, that we're the control group? We just talked a minute ago about 6 degrees of separation, sort of everyone's connected. What does it mean that we're the control group?
Well, I mean, in a sense, you know, I write a lot about the always-on universe. And, you know, we're very familiar with the ways in which being always-on kind of impacts our neurology. It makes us nervous and people are clicking in and, you know, this sense of having to be always-on. And usually we think of it as this idea of, you know, our boss or our friends always being able to tweet us and ping us and put us in this state of kind of constant emergency interruption. But the other side of that coin is that when you're always on, it means you're always observable. It means you're always recorded. So there's this huge data footprint that each of us leave, you know, whether it's, you know, we have a driver's license or not, or 2 doors on our car, or we have a dog or don't have a dog, or this is the way we moved around with in our car today, or this is how many emails we sent. All of these data points, which may or may not have any logic to them, they're just data points. But all of these data points, when they're combined together, they provide a profile of a sort. So they can figure out, using computers, that, well, you know, people who've driven this much in the morning and that much in the afternoon and sent this many emails and that many of this are likely to be getting the flu, or are likely to be, you know, changing their sexual orientation next week, or are likely to buy a new television, or are maybe more likely to be involved in some kind of a terrorist action in the future. You know, so it's really the vast majority of us are the control group for each one of those hypotheses.
Douglas Rushkoff says we're all just bits of aggregate data in this surveillance matrix. Douglas Rushkoff is author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Thank you, Douglas.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think about the NSA using you, at least, as a bit of aggregate data? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always reach us at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to the show. Todd Zwillick with you today. On to the jobs front now. Some tepid news for the Obama administration. It seems jobs numbers are out and they're not looking great this month. An unemployment rate rising to 7.6%. U.S. employers did add 175,000 jobs, but more job seekers entered the market, which means that the numerator isn't as great as it could be. Joining us with the latest is Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for Takeaway, co-producer WNYC. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Todd.
I described it as tepid. You agree?
Yeah, it's kind of a meh. I mean, it's not a bad report. I mean, yes, 175,000 jobs were created. The unemployment rate went up slightly to 7.6%. Like you said, that's not that bad. And this report and the reaction that you're getting is, okay, the economy is sort of continuing to bump along. And in some aspects, this may be a strange oddity that the Federal Reserve has really been waiting to see what happens with the jobs report. And if we saw a huge surge in new jobs created and the unemployment rate falling, you might actually see the Federal Reserve ending some of the extraordinary policies it's put in place to get the economy going. And when that happens, there could be a bit of a momentary freakout by the stock market, by the bond market, as they readjust to a world where the Fed is not trying to support everything. But in terms of this report, things continue to bump along. A lot of service sector jobs added, which isn't necessarily a great thing. And a lot of government jobs cut, not a surprise considering the sequester.
And quickly, Charlie, yeah, I want to ask you about government jobs. That has been seen, sequestration, a cut in government jobs has been seen as a drag on employment and the economy. Where does that stand now?
Well, we saw about 14,000 federal jobs cut in May. That's clearly, you know, part of the sequester. Over the past 3 months, we've seen, you know, the government jobs being cut at the federal level by about 45,000. So this is showing that there is a slowdown effect from the government spending less. But as you and I have talked about before, that is also having that benefit of, you know, less government spending.
7.6% unemployment rose this month. U.S. employers added 175,000 jobs. Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for Takeaway, co-producer WNYC. Charlie, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, speaking of President Obama today, he's in California meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping, far outside the Beltway in Palm Springs. The two leaders have a lot to talk about: North Korea, a cyber attacks to recent reports of Chinese espionage of American companies and institutions. Our next guest hopes that Chinese trade practices are at the top of President Obama's list. Peter Navarro is professor of economics and public policy at the University of California, Irvine. He recently directed a film entitled Death by China. Hi, Peter.
How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Death by China tells me that you think that President Obama needs to get tough with Xi Jinping.
There's no question about it. The film itself is a historical look at the last 12 years since China got into the World Trade Organization and basically had its way with our markets. And, you know, we've lost over 5 million manufacturing jobs. We've shut down over 50,000 factories, and we got 25 million people out there on the streets that are unemployed, and the unemployment numbers, they just don't reflect the full anguish that we have here. And basically, it's not because of Chinese cheap labor, which is kind of the common myth. It's because China cheats. And they use a wide range of illegal trade practices coupled with state capitalism to just take jobs from Europe, from the United States, from Brazil, from Africa, Latin America, and really the president – and the president before him has been so soft on this that this is at the top of my list.
We're told in Washington all the time that officially labeling China a currency manipulator with all of its attendant legal implications is going to do nothing but touch off a trade war with China. Do you buy that?
Well, we're already in a trade war with China, and that's kind of the dirty little secret in D.C. I mean, President Obama, when he was on the campaign trail in 07, promised the American people and the people of Ohio that he would crack down on China as a currency manipulator, and he simply hasn't done it. The currency thing, for people listening, I mean, it's 40% undervalued, which basically means that China slaps on a 40% tariff on American exports to China over and above the explicit 27% tariffs they have. So that's huge. It's very hard to get into their markets. And then it's a 40% subsidy here. So we're in a trade war. The currency thing is really at the top of the list. And, you know, there was a bill just this week that over 200 people in the House signed on to crack down on it. So, yeah, trade war, bring it on if it means basically holding China accountable and getting our jobs back.
Part of the discussion then between President Obama and Xi Jinping, Peter Navarro, is going to be cyber espionage, cyber attacks and espionage both of American companies and institutions. I just want to run this by you because in Foreign Affairs magazine in May, Ambassador Kwee Tian Kai, this was reported in Yahoo News, basically was defiant, basically said the U.S. has no good evidence that China is using cyber espionage on U.S. companies and the government, that basically a lot of attacks on China come from the U.S., sort of you're doing it too, don't pin this on me.
Yeah, this is kind of the great Orwellian Chinese approach to public relations, and it really works within their borders. You know, if you say it enough, they'll believe it if you can control the internet. But there's absolutely no question that China hacks our Pentagon, our FBI, our universities, and our businesses to steal basically our trade secrets, processes, designs, you name it. I mean, this is not in question. And it really is troubling that the government of China is so defiant in its denials. And it does this across the board. I mean, Europe, for example, is threatening tariffs on Chinese solar panels because those panels actually sell for well below the cost of production, which means China dumps. So, you know, what China does is say, oh, we're not dumping. We're going to basically throw tariffs on European wine. And so this is the PRC's MO. And we've got to recognize that unlike Canada, Europe, Australia, even countries like Brazil and Mexico, China is very different. It's a state capitalist totalitarian regime that's out to create jobs for its people at the expense of everybody else in the world. And we're standing by letting that happen and go on our merry way buying Chinese products that are basically being used basically to arm that country in the most rapid buildup we've seen in a very long time.
Well, President Obama is headed to California, is there now actually meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
Yes.
And Peter Navarro says that the president has to get tough. Peter Navarro, professor of economics and public policy at the University of California in Irvine, recently directed a film entitled Death by China. Peter Navarro, thank you.
Thank you so much, my friend.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, less than a month ago, President Obama repeated his wish to close the Guantanamo Bay detention facility in a national speech. Specifically, he addressed the hunger strike that's now in its fifth month there.
Look at the current situation, where we are force-feeding detainees who are being held on a hunger strike. Is this who we are? Is that something our founders foresaw? Is that the America we want to leave our children? Our sense of justice is stronger than that.
Now, since the president said that, there are now 104 hunger strikers at Guantanamo. 41 of them are being force-fed by personnel there. The size of the facility's staff is also growing. Carol Rosenberg, reporter for the Miami Herald, says there's no end in sight. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Todd.
Thanks for joining us. Carol, no end in sight. Why? What's going on in Guantanamo that we can't solve there?
Well, for starters, the general who has oversight on the prison says that there's nothing that the military can do to solve this hunger strike. He calls it hunger strike light, and he says it has to burn out on its own, that the military has nothing to offer the prisoners who are now in lockdown for almost 2 months to help end this protest.
Nothing to offer them. What does that mean? They just have to tire out, lose their motivation?
That seems to be the hope on the side of the military. Last month, the president said that he was going to assign two new czars, point people, to work on Guantanamo closure, one at the State Department and one at the Defense Department. And it seems that nobody wants the jobs. They haven't even floated a name. Meanwhile, the military's answer seems to be, as you said, just throwing more and more troops at it. They brought in 37 extra Navy medical workers. 124 MPs arrive tomorrow. And down here at Southcom, the Pentagon's headquarters for Latin America, they say the goal is to grow the prison camp staff to 2,000 troops and contractors for the 166 prisoners.
Carol, what is the thought of the logic of sort of flooding the zone with personnel? How does that help the hunger strike? Or is it related directly to the hunger strike at all?
Well, it's clear that the hunger strike is extremely labor intensive. Now that you have everybody in lockdown, or all but about 15 prisoners in lockdown, each man inside his own cell, leading a solitary existence, guards have to remove him from his cell in shackles, one guard on each side. He has to be taken to showers in shackles. He has to be taken to the rec yard in shackles. He has to be taken to his forced feedings in shackles, and then shackled into a restraint chair where these Navy nurses and corpsmen put these tubes up their nose, down the back of their throat, and into their stomach to feed them twice a day. It's extremely labor-intensive.
And we understand that those personnel, the officials that you're describing, have told themselves that this isn't force-feeding. I'm not sure I understand how it's not. What do they say?
This is part of the semantics that have gone on at Gitmo for more than a decade. We call them prisoners. They call them detainees. We call it forced feeding. They call it enteral feeding. And remember, nobody's seen this process. Part of it seems to be that the detainees are no longer having to be tackled, shackled, and carried out of their cells for these feedings, that they are, in the terms of the military, compliant, meaning they're just not putting up a fight anymore. The military sees this as part of maybe a choreographed protest, that the prisoners know they'll be fed, so they don't fight. The guards know that the prisoners want to be fed in their interpretation, so they say it's not forced feeding. They say it's re-nourishment or enteral feeding. As for why they need to shackle them into a restraint chair, they say that's part of forced security.
There are 104 hunger strikers now at Guantanamo Bay Prison in Cuba. 41 of them are being force-fed by personnel there, at least semantically. Carol Rosenberg, reporter for the Miami Herald, who has spent a lot of time at Gitmo. Carol, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
The hunger strike underway at Guantanamo is one in a long line of hunger strikes we've seen in the past century. One of the most dramatic hunger strikes in recent decades, 1981, when imprisoned IRA members in Northern Ireland went on strike.
The men of violence have chosen in recent months to play what may well be their last card. They've turned their violence against themselves through the prison hunger strike to death.
Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher refused to negotiate with the hunger strikers, and in total, 10 prisoners starved themselves to death. Irish Republican fighter Pat Sheehan was part of that strike led by Bobby Sands. By the time the fast ended, Pat had gone 55 days without food. Pat Sheehan, former IRA hunger striker, is now a Sinn Féin assembly member.
I don't want to draw any comparison between our hunger strike in 1981 and what is happening in Guantanamo Bay currently. But it sounded to me as if what is happening in Guantanamo is not what President Obama wants to be happening. And I think you have to bear in mind that for anyone to commit themselves to hunger strike, they need to have a really, really serious reason to do so. It seems to me that prisoners who have already been incarcerated for a long time and see no hope of release in the short or medium term, see themselves with no other options other than to pursue this course of action.
Pat Sheehan, of course, we don't want to suggest that you speak for prisoners in Guantanamo or for anyone other than yourself, for that matter. But one thing that you can do for us is take us inside of the mind of a hunger striker, maybe even inside the spirit of a hunger striker. What does it mean to make a decision like this? Do you have to decide that you're willing to die for the cause? Is that the only way a hunger strike is effective?
Well, I think it's important that I point out you don't go on hunger strike to die. You go on hunger strike to try and have the injustice that was perpetrated against you removed. And so in that context, a person going on hunger strike, in the Irish context anyway, when we were on hunger strike, was that we were right and the British were wrong. The British tried to treat us as criminals. We knew we were victims of the political conditions. We believed we should have been treated as political prisoners. And we were prepared, after trying a wide range of other methods to achieve our objectives, we finally decided to go on hunger strike. But it needs absolute determination and resolve to see it through. If your opponent refuses to move or to be flexible, that the person on hunger strike is prepared to go to the death.
Let me ask you about force feeding, Pat Sheehan. I wanted to go there with you. What does force feeding mean to the dynamic here?
Well, I think many of these prisoners have been cleared for release already. If there is evidence against any of the prisoners, they should be brought before the courts and tried. And if the evidence stands up, they should be convicted. But here we have a situation where prisoners have been cleared for release because of some legal or procedural technicality. These prisoners haven't been released. They have decided to go on hunger strike to protest against that injustice. And injustice has been heaped on injustice by the fact that they're now being force-fed.
Pat Sheehan, politics aside, before we let you go, does your experience as a hunger striker for your cause, the hunger striker of Guantanamo Bay prisoners now in Cuba, make you feel any kinship with them at all?
It's not that I don't feel any kinship, but certainly when I hear about hunger strike, it reminds me of what we went through here in 1981. We took that decision to go on hunger strike after giving it very serious consideration. It wasn't a decision we took lightly. I can certainly empathise with those people on hunger strike in Guantanamo I feel that they should not be force-fed. I think it's cruel and it's degrading. We had prisoners on hunger strike in English jails during the 1970s, and one of them was actually killed by the process of force-feeding. But I think our hunger strike in 1981 stands on its own 2 feet.
Pat Sheehan, a former IRA hunger striker, now a Sinn Féin assembly member in Northern Ireland. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, with films like Zero Dark Thirty and Argo, the CIA lately has become major Oscar fodder for Hollywood. But while the movies celebrate the top secret world of CIA officers, it seems that the CIA officers in real life might have revealed a little too much to the filmmakers. Specifically, we're talking about Zero Dark Thirty and the screenwriter Mark Boal and director Catherine Bigelow. According to a report from the Defense Department that was made public earlier this week, the CIA disclosed the names of two special operations personnel involved in the killing of Osama bin Laden and even arranged lunch with one of them. This week, we also learned that in 2011, Leon Panetta, then director of the CIA, revealed the name of the ground commander in the OBL raid at an award ceremony with Zero Dark Thirty director Mark Boal. So, is the CIA getting too cozy with Hollywood is one of the questions for Bill Harlow, former CIA director of public affairs, who has worked closely with Hollywood projects. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, and thanks for joining us. Bill, we've heard before that the CIA likes to vet scripts and sort of get its image into Hollywood movies. How long has this been going on?
Well, it's been going on for quite a while, and I wouldn't say get its image into movies. Actually, for a long time, if the CIA was in a movie, it was almost guaranteed that they were going to be the bad guys. So back in the mid-90s, about the time that I got to the agency after a career in the Navy, we decided that we ought to, on a limited basis, try to work with Hollywood when we could to see if we could get a few movies made in which we were realistically portrayed and not uniformly described as the bad guys.
So I can think of a lot of movies where the CIA are the bad guys. Even in the Bourne movies, it's not the CIA maybe specifically, but certainly implied that they're an evil organization that's just out for power at the expense of lives. But Zero Dark Thirty and Argo are very, very different portrayals. That's intentional? You all set about changing the popular perception of the agency?
Any agency of the government tries to put their best foot forward and to be portrayed as hardworking, patriotic organizations. But in many of these cases, almost all of these cases, it's not the agency going out to Hollywood and saying, you know, please make a movie about us being heroes. It's Hollywood coming to the agency and saying, we want to make a story about the bin Laden raid, for example. Or they come to the agency after having seen press accounts of the Argo situation, and they say, we're going to make a movie about this, you know, can you help us? So the agency makes this decision about, you know, whether they're going to help or not, and part of that depends upon the who's approaching them, their attitude, the script that they provide. The agency doesn't have that much to offer a filmmaker, unlike the military, where if you want to make a movie about an aircraft carrier, there's really only one place you can go where you can borrow one.
Right.
You know, but trench coats are available anywhere. So, but if Hollywood comes to the agency and expresses an interest to learn what they can about information, unclassified information, from time to time the agency will try to help them out to get some of the details right without giving away any secrets.
So, Bill Harlow, former CIA Director for Public Affairs, give us an example, if you would, of one or two films that you helped out on or consulted on, as it were.
The Sum of All Fears, a Tom Clancy movie, was one that we worked with during my time there. Ben Affleck played Jack Ryan, and in the movie he was a younger Russian analyst who worked at the agency. And so we had Affleck come out to the agency and just sit down with some of the people who in the real world did the kind of jobs that he was portraying. So that's the kind of thing that we would work on. There were a number of other movies, also television series. We would provide a little bit of advice to help them get things realistically. There was a series called The Agency on CBS. Hollywood being Hollywood, they will exaggerate things, but to the extent that we could try to help them accurately portray what the agency did without giving away secrets, we wanted to do that for a variety of reasons, to inform the public and also to help the recruiting efforts.
Well, Bill Harlow, what do you think then was at work with the revelations that I described at the top here with Leon Panetta, you know, dropping the name of a ground commander in the OBL raid, in the Zero Dark 30 scenario, that the name of two operatives were revealed that shouldn't have been? Is that an example of the productive relationship, as you're describing it, between the agency and Hollywood maybe going a little bit too far, maybe a case of the director or somebody else getting a little bit too much stardust in their eyes? What do you think happened there?
No, I don't know, having not been there at the time, but obviously if that happened, it was a mistake and shouldn't have happened. On the other hand, I wouldn't make too big a deal of it. You know, while he may have mentioned names, or somebody may have mentioned names to the screenwriter, Mark Bowl, or somebody else, as far as I know, that information never went anywhere else. It certainly isn't in the film. It wasn't revealed to the public, and so while it's unfortunate and inappropriate to share that name with them, I don't see any damage to national security having been done. Obviously, there's potential for it to have been done, but no evidence that it was. So I think, you know, it may have been inadvertent, but I don't understand all the excitement going on now, because I haven't seen any evidence that real damage was done.
So as the public affairs guy for a secret agency, Bill Harlow, you've been reading the news the last couple of days, we all have, of the leaks that came out about NSA programs concerning phone lines, Verizon, we assume other telephone companies, certainly internet companies, Facebook, Google, and all the rest. The public may not differentiate between the NSA and the CIA necessarily. They just think it's American intelligence community. And I wonder if you think that revelations like that, quite apart from national security, hurt efforts of a guy like you to burnish the image, the patriotic image of the CIA. Americans might not be feeling too good about the intel community today.
Well, you know, there are always leaks out there, and there's something that we had to deal with all the time on a regular basis. And part of the difficulty of being a chief spokesman for a secret organization is there's a limited amount that you can do to protect yourself. A lot of times there may be information which would put people's minds at ease, but you're not able to reveal that information because it does more damage rather than just fix the situation. So it's always an uphill battle. There's always people have conspiracy theories in the back of their minds. And almost always, in my experience, that whatever the intelligence agencies do is done at the direction and authorization of the president, and with the informed consent very often of Congress. And yet the intelligence agencies are the ones that take the heat. So it's a challenging time for my successors out there, I'm sure, and for the people who did similar jobs or do similar jobs at NSA and elsewhere.
Bill Harlow is one of the guys that helped the CIA translate the real world of threats and terrorism to the make-believe world of Hollywood. He was former CIA Director of Public Affairs. Mr. Harlow, thank you.
My pleasure.
Friday is movie day here on The Takeaway. This week, we have three exciting movies opening up. Maybe first, The Internship, a comedy reuniting, oh, those guys, Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson, as they take on an internship at where? Google, of course. Next, we have Ethan Hawke starring in The Purge, a thriller where one day a year, all crime is legal. Imagine that. And finally, Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing, a modern take on the Shakespeare play. Is it as good as Firefly? We will find out from our Movie Date team, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, both here to weigh in. Rafer, of course, is film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer is culture producer here at The Takeaway. Hi, guys.
Hi, hey, Todd. How are you?
I'm great. Always great to have you here. You can always subscribe to their podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. Of course. Trivia first, guys. Here we go. We're not going to answer now. We're going to save the answer for the end of the show. But here is your trivia question, Kristen and Rafer. Listeners, follow along, and you can, if you have time, get an answer on the Facebook page. We're talking about The Internship today, starring Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn, of course. Now, Vince Vaughn was in one of the most important movies of the decade, which was Dodgeball, 2004. Tell me, what was the name of the legendary dodgeball champion that the team recruits for coaching and inspiration in Dodgeball? What was the name of the legendary dodgeball coach and inspiration for the team? Double bonus points if you can name who played him. That's your trivia question. All right, now, Kristen Rafer, let's stick with the Vince Vaughn theme here and go on to The Internship. Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson. Let's listen.
This is how people do it now, Nikki. They have their interviews on the internet.
I like it.
I know child.
Okay, here they are. And when I hit this, they'll be able to see us. So come on in, get in here close so we can be seen in the webcam. See how small the webcam is? No, get your cheek. Nick, come here.
But don't crown me.
We can see you guys.
Okay, good.
You got us?
Hi, my name is Billy.
We can hear you fine as well.
Everybody loves it when Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson do their spontaneous banter. Kristen, does it work?
You know, I loved The Wedding Crashers. I'm a Wedding Crashers super fan. I've seen that movie so many times.
Right.
I saw it multiple times in the theater. And in this movie, they have that relationship again. And I have to say, though, that it's not 100% successful here. Vince Vaughn, for the most part, comes off as incredibly irritating. At least for the first third of the movie, he's so irritating that you kind of want him not to succeed at his internship at Google. And it seems that he's not going to. But, of course, he and Owen Wilson have life lessons to impart. If they don't have skills, if they don't have social skills or technical skills, at least they have life lessons to impart. So it's kind of a fish out of water. Let's make this work and find some love in the whole story.
Rafer, there's always a soft side, of course, to these two lovable losers in these movies.
Yeah, you know, what they're basically doing is imparting some wisdom to the young whiz kids, teaching them to look up from their keyboards and take in the world around them, which of course includes a strip club. So
naturally,
it's one of these kind of movies. It's affable, it's good-hearted, it's mostly raunch-free, which I kind of found refreshing. But the humor is a little low-key. There aren't a lot of belly laughs. And I agree with Kristen. The Vaughn-Wilson team, it feels a little lazy. It feels like they're texting it in.
I always like them for their ability to play off of one another. And even if the story is weak, Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn, for me, are just a great comedy team that kind of bounce off each other in the way that pleases me. I might wait for this one to come out on demand, maybe, right?
Yeah.
All right. Now, Rafer, you saw The Purge, which is Ethan Hawke in a new thriller following a family held hostage during a 12-hour period in this make-believe world when all crime, even murder, is legal. Everybody can kind of let off steam in a really criminal way. Listen.
We can enter any home we want, and we will want. Don't force us to hurt you. We don't want to kill our own. Please just let us purge.
There are themes of The Purge in plays like The Lottery and in Star Trek. Does it work?
You know, I didn't expect much from this. Ethan Hawke, it looks like sort of a bad horror film. The posters are very murky. They don't really lead you to know what the movie's about, really. I loved this film. I had a great time in this movie. It's not only is it a great sort of home invasion flick along the line of Straw Dogs, it's pretty subversive and a lot of really interesting social commentary. And basically, you've got these well-heeled suburbanites in their fortress McMansions blocking themselves out from the Purge. And of course, who takes the heat during the Purge? It's the poor.
Sure.
You know, they're the ones dying around all these wealthy suburbanites.
So it has some relevance.
It has some real relevance. It's not a perfect film. It's not that well directed, but the ideas in it are really angry and savage, and they more often than not, they strike home. And I was really impressed by it. I was really glad to see this, and especially in a mainstream multiplex. Nice to see something like this.
There's a vote for The Purge from Rafer Guzman. Now, Kristen, you saw Much Ado About Nothing, which is a modern telling of the Shakespearean play from Joss Whedon. Let's listen.
I wonder that you would still be talking, Signor Benedict. Nobody marks you.
What, my dear lady, disdain, are you yet living?
Is it possible disdain should die while she hath such meat food defeated as Signor Benedict? Courtesy itself must convert to disdain if you come in her presence.
Then is courtesy a turncoat? But it is certain I am loved of all ladies, only you excepted.
Kristen, I'm a sucker for anything Shakespeare. I will see this whether you like it or not because I just can't turn away from these films. But I love Firefly from Joss Whedon. It's one of the best things I've ever seen. Does that lead me to love this too?
You know, I don't think you have to be a lover of Joss Whedon's whole world. You don't have to love Firefly. You don't have to love Buffy. You don't have to love the Avengers. This movie's just delightful on its own. What we just heard was Benedict and Beatrice. They are two lifelong bachelors who, through some sort of Three's Company scenario, and misunderstandings are suddenly finding themselves falling in love with each other. And it's just whimsical. It's funny. It's sexy, romantic. And I had such a good time watching this movie. I really highly recommend it.
There's a vote for Kristen Meinzer from Much Ado About Nothing. As I said, I'm seeing it regardless, and now I feel good about seeing it. Thank you, Kristen. All right, guys, let's move on to trivia here at the end. As I told you, since we're talking about Vince Vaughn, the most important film he ever made was Dodgeball in 2004. And I asked you, what is the name of the legendary dodgeball champion that the team recruits for coaching and inspiration? Listen.
But remember, dodgeball is a sport of violence, exclusion, and degradation.
Who are we listening to there? What's the character's name?
I just saw this in a bar the other night, and I can't remember. I'm stumped.
Oh, Kristen?
Gosh. I have no idea, but I just want to say Will Ferrell as Ron Burgundy because I love Will Ferrell as Ron Burgundy.
So very wrong. You are listening to the legendary dodgeball champion, Patches O'Houlihan, played there by the incomparable Hank Azaria. Old Patches played by Rip Torn. So you missed the character and you missed the bonus. Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer are a Movie Date team. You didn't get trivia, but thanks for the recommendations, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
Well, as we're learning more about the government's internet surveillance program, we are hearing from you.
This is Mike from New Jersey. I think the surveillance program is absolutely okay. This is war. It's the only way that we can track the terrorists that might be plotting stuff. If, again, you're not doing anything wrong, then you have nothing to worry about.
Some of you say that most of our digital information is out there anyway.
This is Christina from Austin. I find it really interesting that everyone freaks out about the government watching what they're doing when everybody happily posts everything about their life on Twitter and Facebook. People, if anybody wants to watch you, you post it all for them one way or the other. They don't need a government warrant or anything like that.
Well, this is life during wartime, 12 years after 9/11 in the United States. We've been hearing from you on the issue of phone companies and internet companies contributing to surveillance from the National Security Agency. And this is an issue that we really want to hear from you on. As always here at The Takeaway, you can give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. And always reach us on the website at thetakeaway.org. John is in Minnesota next week. I will be in Washington. And you can listen to him there. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.